to become part of the consciousness of her era. And he goes on to describe post-colonialism as a wide-ranging political project that has always aspired to turn the power structures of the world upside down and to refashion the world from below. End quote. To present post-colonial studies as reissuing the old revolutionary call requires that this be accompanied by a coherent analysis of why and to what ends the world is in urgent need of upheaval, as well as strategies for effecting insurrection. And this, as even those only mildly acquainted with the field will know, has been and remains anathema to high profile commentators who erased conflict from their narratives of colonialism and rejected the notion of struggle. So let us recall that writing in the 1890s and I guess the late 80s, Homi Bhabha's mission was to effect a breakup of a binary sense of political antagonism in order to demonstrate colonialism as a mode of authority that is agonistic rather than antagonistic, and to displace the received perception of dichotomies in conflict with the in-between space of negotiation. His writings are replete with words like ambivalent, borderline, boundary, contingent, dispersal, dissemination, hybridity, in-between, indeterminate, interstitial, liminal, marginal, transactional, translational, uncertain, and undecidable. Registering a stance which brings to mind Frederick Jameson's remark that at stake in such moves is the rolling back of Hegel and Marx by way of a conceptual discrediting of contradiction and dialectical opposition. During the last decade, this reconciliatory position has been further entrenched. Writing about the future of comparative literature in Death of a Discipline, Gayatri Spivak urged the necessity of eschewing the politicization of the discipline, advancing instead a depoliticization of the politics of hostility towards a policy of friendship to come. And in Affective Communities, 2004, a year later, Leela Gandhi gives full-throated voice to this vocation in undertaking to promote an alternative history of anti-imperialism, one that recuperates the politics of friendship to replace the politics of conflict. This she does by looking at a very small number of metropolitan, mainly British, and all theatrically eccentric persons whose capacity for personal hybridity and empathy with radical alterity, she maintains, enabled them to develop an affinity with the oppressed, this constituting an ethical demonstration of hospitality and xenophilia that runs counter to the story of antagonism and struggle. Such moves may appear outlandish to those who would argue for the active politicization of the discussion about comparative literature and the imperial encounter, together with the concretely grounded analysis of the post-colonial within the horizons of global conditions spanning metropolitan and peripheral. The direction of work being done in post-colonial studies, however, tends to hail the globalization of capitalism as marking a foundational change in the nature of imperialism, or a paradigm shift to a post-imperialist age. Bhabha, for example, reiterates what I find to be the most impoverished and mindless understanding of global capitalism. Globalization, he wrote, and this is fairly recently, propagates a world made up of virtual transnational domains and wired communities that live vividly through webs and connectivities on the line. An explanation from which all mention of structural, institutional, and social matters are missing. Instead, significance is accorded to the flows of populations, culture, and knowledge, to transnationalism, deterritorialization, dispersal, diaspora, cosmopolitan, etc. Hence the indifference to the immiseration of populations, native as well as immigrant, in the metropolitan world. Accompanying this tendency is the revisionary impulse of post-colonial critics to situate revolutionary figures whose work has been conscripted to the agenda of post-colonial studies as decent center-left thinkers. So far, attempts have been made to overpower Frantz Fanon and Antonio Gramsci with conformism. David Macy, Fanon's most recent and to date his major biographer, has questioned the legitimacy of the post-colonial Fanon, construed by critics who dismiss Fanon's specific political commitments as obsolescent. Insisting that these were beliefs, Macy insisting that these beliefs were ones for which he has lived and would have been prepared to die for. While Leo Zelig has protested that in the 1990s, Fanon was taken up with renewed vigor by the Academy, who presented a largely decontextualized Fanon, shorn of history. Here he was, with his revolutionary urgency and heart ripped out. As to Gramsci, the makeover was begun some time ago in Italy and continued by the Suburban Studies Collective in India and New Left Tendencies in Europe. And this year we have a volume of essays called The Postcolonial Gramsci, where the editors set out to liberate Gramsci's thought from the restrictions of Marxist thinking, which they complain, quite contrary to the spirit of Gramsci's own writings, steadfastly offer a constrained framework as the true context of his political writing. While the volume contains some well-researched essays, there is a recurrent theme reclaiming Gramsci as an unorthodox and dissident Marxist. For example, his thought was unusual within the general paradigm of European Marxism, providing crucial tools that helped to break with Marxist orthodoxy. He fled from Marxism's doctrinal inflexibility in analyzing third world struggles and was against the thrust of orthodox Marxist thinking. He repudiated the conventional economic determinism of Marxist theory and confronted the limits of Marxist theories of his own time. It is as if these contributors have forgotten to remember that he was and remained a Marxist and a communist. The last word, by the way, is absent from the index. And that Marxism has always generated a variety of interpretations and elaborations. But because I am discussing the retrievals attempted by post-colonial studies, I want to observe that the post-colonial revision of the subaltern supersedes Gramsci's later and precise use of the term to identify the class position of the southern peasantry within the Italian political order and class structure of the 1920s. This allows Robert Young, in his essay in the volume, to declare that since the singular figure of the subaltern woman was definitively introduced by Gayatri Spivak, in a sense it was Spivak and not Gramsci who invented the subaltern. In these maneuvers to reconstruct what was said in the past within the orbit of Marxist historical materialism and other left thinking, are we perhaps dealing with an emergent mode of criticism that can be described as in praise of misprision, and which is not limited to post-colonial studies? Here I refer to another instance of reappraisal that appears indifferent to authorial intention and spirit, and again targets radical left thinking. In this case, it is also directed at another dead Marxist revolutionary and has been made by public intellectuals who have either renounced or hitherto distanced themselves from Marxism. The first citation is from Sheila Rowbottom, who in reviewing the recent publication of Rosa Luxemburg's letters resituates Luxemburg as an outspoken critic of Marxism before making a claim for her importance to left feminism. Quote, Luxemburg's criticism of Marxism as dogma and her stress on consciousness exerted an influence on the women's liberation movement which emerged in the late 60s and early 70s. When I was writing Woman's Consciousness, Man's World, during 1971, I drew on her analysis, listen, in the accumulation of capital, of capital's greedy quest for non-capitalist markets, adopting as a metaphor for the commodification of sexual relations and the body. Should anyone in the audience join me in cringing at the reductivity and immodesty of this homage, then a more complex reaction will be required to the widely publicized and better informed review by Jacqueline Rose in the London Review of Books. While Rose allows that Luxemburg adhered to the Marxist credo, interspersed in the article are allusions to or assertions of Luxemburg's dissidence concerning the concept of the party and her breach with Lenin and Leninism. What Rose reiterates as crucial to understanding Luxemburg was that the obliqueness of her position as a woman and a Jew, her status as an outsider, gave her a freedom to think the unthought, I'm quoting Rose, to think the unthought, to force the unthinkable into the language of politics, adding, I have long believed this to be one of feminism's supreme tasks, what it has to contribute to political understanding. Principally, what Rose appreciates and praises are, I quote, to the immense irritation of her opponents and detractors, she elevated uncertainty to a principle, to a revolutionary creed. It is, as I see it, the thread that runs through her unwavering belief in democracy and freedom, as well as socialism. Uncertainty is what allows us to see how these three depend on each other, and is the link in her life and thought between the public world of politics and the intimacies of the mind. Peter Hudis, one of the editors of the letter, and who has expressed some admiration for Rose's article, has responded thus to her stress on uncertainty. It's a long quote, but it's very telling. When it came to tracing out the trajectory of capitalist accumulation, uncertainty and unpredictably was not what Luxemburg emphasized. Her theory of capital accumulation was predicated on the argument that capitalism must of necessity take over and destroy non-capitalist strata in order for surplus value to be realized. No less central to her argument was the claim that pre-capitalist forms of land tenure and social relations would inevitably dissolve and be destroyed once the capitalist relation comes in contact with them. As Luxemburg states in her introduction to political economy, in speaking of non-capitalist social formations in the developing world, as she writes, there is only one contact that it cannot tolerate or overcome. This is the contact with European civilization, that is, with capitalism. For the old society, this encounter is deadly universally and without exception. Where, Herdes asks, is the emphasis on openness and uncertainty in this formulation? Clearly, when it came to analyzing the trajectory of capitalism, the alienated form of objectified labor, Luxemburg emphasized predictability and certainty above all else. Another review by a literary academic and a Marxist in the United States also happens to be Neil's ex-student. Helen Scott, is as stringent in its criticisms, faulting Rose for factual errors concerning her relationship with Lenin, for implying that Lenin and Luxemburg represented diametrically opposed traditions, and for drawing attention to her criticism of the Bolsheviks without observing her leadership of the illegal Polish Party, or the fact that she dedicated the last months of her life in Germany to building a revolutionary movement akin to the Bolsheviks. Rather than, as Rose suggests, reproaching a cause for destroying all that is finest in the human being, Scott contends that this is not only inaccurate, nowhere in the letters does she make such a charge, but in complete opposition to Luxemburg's own words and deeds. Not only in her writing, but in her life and her death, Scott insists, she committed herself to the cause precisely because she saw and resisted all the ways that capitalism, imperialism, war, poverty and oppression restrain and distort human potential. As she puts it in the mass strike, revolutionary struggle allows workers to overcome the levication and the decay to which they are condemned under the daily yoke of capitalism. When reading Rowbottom and Rose on Luxemburg, I was aware of two unexamined assumptions. The first concerns the nature of letters, which, except for the veil, are not written for posterity and register thinking in process, instant opinion, momentary reaction, passing irritation or enthusiasm, and so on. The other is how stultified is the view, the prevalent view, on the nature of discussion within Marxist and other left circles, where the exchange of fiercely opposed views can remain a hermeneutic discourse directed at analyzing real-world situations, which is left theory's reason for being, ideally and often actually conducted without personal rancor or the goal of winning the argument. Such instances can even be recuperated from the documents of political parties whose well-known proclivity to deadly altercation and fissure is persistently mocked, even though it is not so distant from the animosities and splits within psychoanalytic theory, and is perhaps a measure of taking ideas seriously rather than adhering to dogma. I want now to try and understand the position I earlier referred to as in praise of misprision, which it seems to me is something quite other than the practice of interpretation. A flyer for a recent series of postcolonial seminars called on Viktor Shklovsky's book, The Energy of Delusion, to ground the claim that, I cite, misinterpreting the author's intent and following the deceptive lead of the narrative has been surprisingly productive in many representative cases across various disciplines. So let me pass on the intelligence made available by a colleague, Kaya Ganguly, who points out that Shklovsky was a Russian formalist and the book was on how plot functions, centering not on literary interpretation, but on literary production, as against anything metacritical. It seems to me, Kale writes, quite deluded to represent this work as advocating misinterpretation of an author. Far from resembling a free-floating reading against the grain, Shklovsky's argument, rather, centers on how narrative meanders and thus produces unexpected links between literature and the world. It is emphatically not an argument on behalf of misinterpretation. This is itself a misinterpretation. It is, I think, necessary to differentiate between responsible and reckless readings of theoretical texts, between propositions concerning the partiality and unreliability of the author, or detecting reversals of authorial intention, and that critical practice which asserts the instability of all writing. This last is a license to ignore the central thrust of given works and hence to promote incongruous readings. The first position is related to the idea of symptomatic reading. I'm sorry I'm stumbling, but I have and remain unwell, and I'm finding it quite difficult to read. The first position is related to the idea of symptomatic reading, a strategy for the interpretation of theoretical and literary texts suggested by Althusser and followed by Macheret, and is concerned with the meaning of a work that exceeds what is said. This is not to be confused with deliberated misinterpretation. Where in the scheme of things does a position advancing the notion of misreading belong? If it is a strategy for draining Marxism and indeed all left thought of its revolutionary impulses and energies, it is one to be resisted and countered, not in the interests of a sterile rigor, but in Benjamin's words, to rescue the past and the dead, to rescue a tradition and its receivers from being overpowered by conformism. There was a time when prominent and apprentice postcolonial critics would casually dismiss or deride Marxism. This insouciant gesture may be less easy to perform now that Marxism has regained a significant place in the wider intellectual discussion. Now that Marxist scholars are re-examining and glossing the founding texts and alter the fall in advancing further analysis of capitalism and promoting an understanding of globalization as a political project directed at the worldwide restructuring of economic and social relationships and not a transcendence of the profound structural unevenness and inequalities between core and periphery or semi-periphery. Perhaps positions in post-colonial studies are by now too entrenched, and if so, it will appear redundant to caution against those stances which hypostasize notions or opinions with scant regard for empirical substantiation, or to urge the superstition of an exclusive concern with once colonized locations. Amongst other directions, I look forward not to the subsumption of post-colonial studies, but its integration into the critique of the global capitalist system, and with this an engagement with dispossession and immiseration in both core capitalist countries, the semi-peripheries and the peripheries. Given the accumulation of research and thinking dispersed across the field, there are many who contribute to understanding the present world order in registers structural, cultural, and aesthetic, as in attending to the contested discussion on world literature by understanding this as the literature of the global capitalist system, or examining within one framework the forms and articulations of metropolitan and peripheral modernity. The fruition of such ventures will require expanded political horizons and may perhaps begin to address what is left in post-colonial studies.
Some questions and comments if people would like to address them directly to her.
But I would also like you to talk amongst yourselves.
Or to talk among yourselves, she says. in orderly fashion, of course.
I was interested in what you think the scale of post-colonial scholarship and engagement in political spheres is to be like, say, Edward Said's